From the Basement, the only blockchain podcast that interviews the forgotten and downtrodden devs that actually do the work, hosted by me, Martin G. And this episode, we have Richard Green, a stalwart of the Corda community who has 25 years experience working for Blue Chip Financial Services Company. He served in Basra, Iraq, during the war. He took time out, did that with the Honourable Artillery Company, and after setting up R3, he became was it head of engineering?
I can't quite take credit for setting up R3, Martin. There's a few things there. I'm not downtrodden and forgotten. Hopefully not. I didn't quite set up R3. Let's.
Did I just say that? Did I?
Yes, you did. So please, let's.
Maybe I should. Anyway, I think I should start again.
No. Carry on. That's fine. That's fine.
Richard did not set up R3. However, he was an original, an OG, I think, first 20, 20, 30, 40, 50
Number 17,
people.
I think.
Number 17, there you go. Number 17, yes. And after becoming, was it head of engineering at Blockshaw? What was it?
Well, actually, I was head of strategy and technical something or other. It wasn't head of engineering, but it was strategic and tactical stuff, i.e., you know, get the projects working effectively and efficiently on Corda. So yeah. I actually can't remember the title.
Fair enough. And after that, he went off and set up a consultancy, one of the best, he tells me, one of the best Corda consultancies, called Renio DLT, along with his partner in crime, Patrick Kuo.
That's right, so, absolutely. And we're also joined with Michal Kitt and Anthony Keenan as well. So there's we're four strong now. So quite a powerhouse, as I like to say.
Right. Well, look, let's crack on with these 20 questions then, shall we? And then we can get down to asking you all about Cordium. So first up, what company do you work for?
Well, as you just mentioned, Martin, I work for this company called Renio DLT or Renio, and basically very boutique professional services company doing fixing Corda stuff or doing Corda stuff when people get frustrated with other channels of trying to get things done. What's quite unique about it is it's all XR3 engineers. Like I said, there's myself, Patrick, Anthony, and Michal. We've all spent a couple of years each in R3 doing various bits of Corda, so we know it extremely well, I'd say. And so we know which bits it does well and which bits it doesn't do so well. In a quick summary.
Fantastic. What do you do there? What do you do for them?
What do I do? I try and do a bit of software engineering. I try and do some programming and some coding from time to time and blah, blah, blah. But mainly I do the stuff that makes the company actually get the work in and you know, the sales and marketing and stuff, I guess, whatever, because nobody else will do it for us, right? So unless I do it, then nobody else is going to do it. But you know, once we do have a client on board, then I can actually start doing the interesting stuff, the coding and development, and you know, the stuff that I actually want to do, as opposed to the stuff that I'm not quite comfortable with, like you're ringing people up and emailing them saying, yes, you do want to hire us, et cetera.
There you go. Though you say to your clients, you sell Richard Green, and they actually get Richard Green. Amazing.
Yes. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, actually.
Well, at least I don't get some 20-year-olds, you know, straight out of uni, right? Do you have a nickname?
Not really. I think the closest to a nickname I've got is the imaginative Greenie, which I know, right? Exactly. So Greeny, I think, is probably has come from the army in my school days. There we go.
How old were you when you started programming?
God, when did the ZX81 come out? Subtract my age, or subtract the year. and then figure that out. I guess so, about 10 or 11, I think. I guess that was the earliest I could have done, because before that, you literally didn't have the capability to program, right? The ZX81 was the first computer that you could actually have in your house and program with an element of, I don't want to say professionalism, but just capability, because nothing else existed before then apart from very basic programmable calculators, which weren't really programming, right?
Where did you grow up?
Grew up in a place called Selsey Bill, which was the home of Patrick Moore. He used to have a couple of telescopes there and stuff. Indeed, because really? It's very close. It's on the south coast. It was very good for minimal light pollution at the time. So he decided to live there after the war, I think. And the place he grew up in. And I used to see him every now and then on his bicycle riding around in the cricket club, in the Curry House, etc., etc. So lovely chap he was.
Oh, really? Patrick Moore. Amazing. Where did you go to uni and what did you study?
So I went to Bristol University to study maths and statistics, but I changed to just a pure maths course after the first year, I think. It was really eye-opening, actually, because I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea that the moment you do maths as a degree, there's no numbers in it at all. You know, Basically, up until that point, O-levels, GCSEs, A-levels, et cetera, it's always numbers, 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 numbers. Tiny bit of theoretical bit. Suddenly, when you enter the world of degree level maths, literally there's no numbers at all. It's just formula, proofs, theorems, corollaries, etc., etc. A bit of a shock, but came out the other end, survived, and then I've probably never used that maths ever again in my life.
So. Wow. When did you start working in software?
Okay, so I was actually kind of had half a foot into software when I was working for a company that sold gas. Shell and Esso formed a consortium to Shell Natural Gas in England, and the market opened up, and I started helping their software guy, whatever, by doing these simple database queries, blah blah blah, and then I found out I had a bit of a knack or a talent to it. Well, actually, I did a bit of programming as in my degree as well. We had to do stuff in Fortran, but not, I don't know if that would count or not. And then coincidentally, a friend I'd graduated with found a role in Warburgs, SG Warburgs, as they were called, for the title of operational analyst in their IT division or whatever. And it just so happened that the job I had at Shell and Esso was operational analyst. So they naturally assumed that there would be a transference of capability or whatever. But it's very fortuitous, because I had a great mentor there and a great team that, you know, saw that I could actually code stuff and do stuff. So I guess my first real programming job was, the SG Warburgs.
And they of course, became UBS.
Eventually, yes. Yeah, went through many iterations. Well done. Yeah, SG Warburgs, SBC Warburgs, SBC, SBC UBS, and then finally UBS.
Which industry have you spent most of your career in?
Well, it is technology of some flavor, right?
Oh, you can't say that. So, we know it's technology. You have to say the sector.
Okay. Our sector. God. Well, probably finance in the sector then. Because it's mainly around the banks. You know, the banks love technology. I worked in technology. I was drawn in by the allure of how much they would pay someone to do technology in banks. So, you know, there we go. Very dull answer, I'm afraid. But it worked well for me in my 20s and 30s.
What's your operating system of choice?
Oh, God. Can I say OS Warp?
What? Is that a real operating system?
It used to be. What was it? The IBM brought out the multitasking Windows operating system just before Microsoft did. But then Microsoft killed it by not allowing any of their Word, their Office suite to run on it.
which is a shame. So which ones would I like to use? Well, so the Amiga had an operating system actually, which was quite fascinating because that had true multitasking stuff and it had true dedicated hardware for bits, a sound chip and a graphics chip and blah blah blah. So that was actually a joy to work on because that was probably the first operating system I actually used where you could literally have two console windows running at the same time doing different things. Actually, it was miraculous to see because up until that point, a computer would have one screen, one text entry window, one console. That was it. You'd run your command, it would wait, and then when it finished, it would come back. Whereas at the Amiga, you could actually start doing multiple things at the same time, which was, amazing to see. And probably people wouldn't believe you that you could run more than two programs at once, or that you, or there was actually a time people would believe you there was actually a time where you couldn't run two programs at once.
There you go. That is the best answer I think I've heard ever.
Oh,
What is your
wow.
programming language of choice?
Oh, I don't have one
No.
particularly, but if I really want to do something, then I'd probably revert to Python. Just because it's kind of friendly and stuff. Although I've been using Kotlin now for so long, I just, Kotlin combined with a decent editor, IDE, obviously IntelliJ is, as always, it gives you so much power when it's the variables are strongly typed. When everything's strongly typed, then suddenly the editor can help you out so much. So whereas Python's always going to just take a guess, then Kotlin will be definitive in like, oh yeah, if you've got an object of a string, then you can do this and this and this on it. Whereas Python is like, I've got no idea what object you've got, but you just go ahead and if it works, if it runs, then great. That's strongly typed languages versus non-strongly typed in a nutshell.
Okay. When was the last time you wrote some code and what did it do?
Well, I did actually. Did I write some code today? No, I didn't write some code today, actually. But I did write some code this week, and this is a subject of mine after a fascinating subject that I'd like to look into after watching this Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma.
Brian.
Okay, now if you haven't seen it, it's about how bad social media is for everybody, and it's actually a really good documentary, and I'd advise everybody to watch it. And one of the things that they talked about is how much these social media companies need data, data, data. So I thought I'd write a little experiment, and in this program I've written, you generate your own social network, and it's got hundreds of thousands of people in it, and they've all got their contacts and their friends, et cetera, et cetera. And I did something very simple. I said either they like cats or they like dogs, okay? Or they have a tendency to like cats or they have a tendency to like dogs. And there's a variable between 0 and 100, which 50 being in the middle. And then I said, well, what I'll do is I'll make each of these people post invent an article about cats or dogs and whether cats are great or whether dogs are great and whatever. And all the people they're friends with will notionally read the article, and then their view on cats and dogs will change. Because this is kind of similar to what we see on social media at the moment, isn't it? You go on Facebook, and your friends are, like cats, or your friends don't like dogs, or whatever. So they'll post, oh, I saw a dog bite a postman the other day. And the influence is, of course, all the people who read that are then get a slight bias towards cats and dogs because it's their friend who's saying it. Anyway, so what I did with this bit of code, I thought, well, hold on a minute. People only have a certain amount of time to read so many posts per day, so let's limit that. And then I thought, what happens if, say, the big dog industry comes in and gives my? No, this is where it gets interesting. This is where it's
Go
absolutely fascinating. So, big dog industry comes in and says, okay, social network, I don't need to post any adverts on dogs in your social network, but what I'd like you to do is prioritize stories that make dogs better in the eyes of the reader. And this is super easy to do if you think about language mechanics and stuff. You can
Yeah.
analyze what the story is about and say, oh, this portrays dogs. And so what happens is, of course, is the social network then orders these stories so that the happy dogs and the bad cats are at the top of the list. So when their friends read them, they then get biased towards dogs. And within literally a few iterations,
it's all like modeling and whatever. You can literally see people go, oh, aren't cats rubbish? Dogs are wonderful. And you can see this whole, you know, population start swaying towards liking dogs and disliking cats, for example. Now, what I'd like to do is put a few more variables in it, stuff like that, and show how basically dangerous social media is for people. Even as trivial as like, oh, well, you know, I just post something about this person or this person or this, not this person, this subject or whatever. You can just literally change the order in which they're presented to their readers, and that will create a bias. So anyway, that's what I coded.
Amazing! Wow. Suddenly, I want to have a go playing with some subjects.
Well, it looks like crap. So it's bad yet. But if I could put a nice JavaScript front end to it and put it on the web, then they can put it up, and you know, people will say, oh, you know, I like dogs, and you can literally, you know, pretend that you're a user, and then you can see the order of the stories get shuffled around, and then you know, it's not about that individual changing their view, it's about the population as a whole slowly shifting towards one bias or another. So I don't mean to upset you there, Martin. I don't mean to.
No, you haven't upset me. No. I just think it's absolutely fantastic. I think it's amazing. What's your favourite music to listen to whilst you code?
Oh my god! So I just put on electro swing. Electro swing, random garbage, whatever. Caravan Palace, maybe. Stuff that's just vaguely got a tempo to it. Nothing with any lyrics because they're way too distracting. And then just put it on random shuffle, away you go. A couple of hours later, think, what on earth have I been listening to? You know, where's this playlist gone now? Who knows? But yeah, that seems to work for me.
Awesome. Name one skill that all programmers should have.
One skill. Now, you did actually give me a few of these questions beforehand, so I should have thought about this. So the skill one programmer should have is be able to ask the question why. Okay, and if you can ask the question why, then you can normally preempt a lot of the issues that you may have by doing what you've been asked to do. Or if they tell you why in the first place, then that's fine. But if you don't understand why, then feel free to ask it, because understanding that will suddenly make whatever you've been asked to do a lot more reasonable, or you'll be able to empathize with the requests coming down.
Great. Is agile, is it a force for good or for bad?
So I can give you a little story about why agile I think is better than any, well, not better than anything else, but agile is better than, say, waterfall. I used to work for a company, which I won't name, because it's a big enough company. Everyone's heard of them. The financial powerhouse, blah, blah, blah. And I was given these specifications to write. It was actually a GUI in Visual C++ at the time. And in these specifications were the screens that I was asked to write. Literally, okay, there was not a lot of logic behind the screens, but in the specifications were these screens. And the specifications were written 6 months ago. Or maybe even 9 months ago, and they'd been written and approved and signed off and yes, whatever. And eventually I got to them and I said, well, when you did these screens, what did you use to write the screens in? You know, what utility did you use or something? And I think, I don't remember what the answer is. I said, well, when you were drawing these screens, if you had just used the Visual C++ GUI builder tool, you would have the screens now, you know. It wasn't a case of like, you know, do them in a drawing tool and then you know, press execute or whatever. He'd literally drawn them in something else. And at that point, I thought, well, this is where agile is beneficial, right? Because what can happen is you can iterate on these designs and then basically have it, you know, ready when the task is done. Now, obviously, agile doesn't work well when some of these tasks are, you know, 3 to 6 months of research and development or design and stuff like that. But for a lot of projects, agile does a good job. So yes, a force for good.
There we are. do you or have you ever owned any Bitcoin?
I have owned an embarrassing number of Bitcoin. Well, not embarrassing, actually. No, it's about 50.
Because you're filthy rich.
One time. Yes, well, the fact is embarrassing is because I no longer own those 50 Bitcoin.
Oh, no. You owned 50. 50 Bitcoins.
50 Bitcoin. Oh. Yes. I was giving them... I famously gave away half a Bitcoin to a chap who... I think he gave me 20 quid for them at the time or something. I know, right?
Did he keep them?
I think he did, actually. Yes, 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 yes. He never told me he sold them. I had two physical Bitcoins at one point. I cashed those in for do some plastering, I think.
Famous. At least it wasn't a pizza, right?
At least it wasn't a pizza, indeed. And I do believe I was actually the first person to have ever spent Bitcoin to buy beer in England.
Oh yeah,
because I found a pub that accepted Bitcoin at one point, and I went there and I actually told the bar staff, a bit embarrassing, "Do you accept Bitcoin here?" And they're like, "Oh, we're not so sure." And I said, "Well, according to your website, you do. So can I buy some beer from you?"
Yeah.
And they're like, "Oh, okay." So that was the Pembury Tavern. Actually, is a great pub. Has board games and decent beer in there as well. And at one point, they accepted Bitcoin. They may still do. Who knows?
Great. How long have you been using Corda for?
Since it was called Corda. Since, you know, I could actually say, hand on heart, I was probably the first Corda app developer ever.
Yeah.
Because I wrote the interest rate swap app with Rick Parker, actually, at the time. He was doing some bits of it. And you know, so since then.
And haven't you got a pull request claim to fame as well? Didn't you do the first pull request on Corda as well or something?
Okay, so I don't know what story this is, but on my first day, I did a pull request. Actually, no. On my first day, I didn't do a pull request. I did a commit to master. And that was rapidly followed by an email from Mike Hearn about 15 minutes later saying, "Yeah, we don't do commits to master. We do pull requests." And I said, "Well, what about all these commits to master that these other people have been doing?" "Nope, we don't do those nowadays. It's all pull requests." So I was like, okay. So I did a commit to master and pull request on my first day at R3. And then I did another pull request to fix the typo in my first pull request. Because, yeah, that was a slight mistake. Anyway.
Oh, maybe they can forgive you because it was your first day. What? Yeah. Why did you get into Corda?
Because I saw there was a huge interest in blockchain. I was at Barclays at the time, and they had the powerhouse that is Simon Taylor there at the time, actually, of 11FS, and he was flying the flag about blockchains and stuff because he could see that it was going to be a revolution of you know, maybe a slow revolution, but a revolution in transactional in business transactions, I guess. So Barclays there had they weren't interested in blockchain, but there were some clever people at Barclays that I did view as good industry leaders and plot setters, as it were. I'd interviewed Richard Brown for Barclays. James Carlyle was leaving Barclays to work for R3, and obviously Mike Hearn was rumored to be starting to work for a blockchain firm, and he started working for R3. And I thought, well, if these people that I have, I do have a certain amount of respect for their technical nous, are going to this company, then I'll start trying to see if I can get in there as well. So I started badgering a few people at R3, and then I had a phone call from Mike Kern at one point, who then turned that into a video call, who then turned it into a video interview with no notice whatsoever. I always say from that moment on, the standards went a lot higher up before they hired any coders. the last one to sneak in under the net.
You snuck in under the hood. Amazing.
Yeah.
What's the best thing about Corda?
So I think it was probably the imagination of using the JVM in order to develop contracts in. So whereas every other blockchain platform out there was having to write their own language in order to make these contracts to validate the transactions. They just thought, well, hold on, the JVM is pretty standard. It's been around a bit. It's mature. It can be completely deterministic. So why not just use a JVM or a variant thereof? So that I found very very fascinating application of technologies mashed together.
Yeah. What's the worst thing about Corda?
Well, where do you start? I mean, there's countless things that could be improved on it. There's countless things that need to be improved. There's a number of things that don't need to be improved. I would like to see a free and open Corda network, which doesn't have the rigidity of what the Corda network should be. But just like a kind of a Wild West place where people can put their own apps up and people can transact with stuff, and they don't necessarily guarantee that something's going to happen out the other side, but just something where people can, you know, like a Wild West internet, but Corda style.
So, but not because you've got the what do they call it, the user the UAT.
Yeah, you've got the UAT some networks out there, but they're all. That they're still, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being regulated and policed and, you know, KYC'd and stuff.
So you'd like a dark net of the Corda.
Well, it's not a dark net, but it's just a Wild West where you don't, you know, people can fire up nodes, people can start transacting, people can do stuff. Because that's the only way you'll actually see if it has a take up outside regulated environments.
Why would that be an advantage?
Just because then you can see what people would use it for. You can actually start looking at hundreds of other use cases which aren't necessarily applicable to a strictly regulated network.
Okay, cool. What is your favorite Corda open source library?
Favorite Corda open? I don't think I can name any actually. Can you give me some examples?
The Token SDK is open source.
Oh, okay.
but it doesn't have to be written by someone who works for R3. There's hundreds of open source libraries. What about all the Lab 577 ones? Corda.
Yeah, true. Lab 577 have done some.
All the ones that Persistence have written.
Well, then I'd have to put a shout out for the NMS. And it's not an open source library, but it's an open source utility that that I think was sorely needed at the time of production, at the time of publication. Anyway, the shout out for the NMS because Fuzz's work on that was very good, very well received.
Fair enough. There you go. We've got Manos Batsis.
Okay.
Yeah, there's hundreds. It's outrageous. Yeah.
Well, I'll stick with the NMS. I'll stick with the NMS for the time.
No, here. Understandable. What is finally? What's the best place to start with Corda?
From what perspective? From a developer's perspective?
Yeah, if you want to start learning Corda, and you're a developer, where should you start?
I think you have to go to docs.corda.net, don't you? You know, it's the R3 do a very good job of getting that developer material up to scratch and ready. There's no other comparison at the moment, are there? Is there?
No. So now I want to ask you about Cordium. Was one of the big topics. Of CordaCon.
It's huge. The biggest topic, obviously. Nothing to do with Intel and R3, obviously. But,
Conclave.
Yeah. Who needs that?
All the new companies that have gone to production.
Oh, so I can do a little 30 seconds on Chordium now. So, yeah, so Chordium is Chordium. It's a tool that we've written in, and it's amazing for developers to use to look and see what's happening in their node. Basically, you could download this single jar file. You can put it into your Chord Apps directory. That's all the installation that's required. It gives you a web interface. You can do loads of things. You can. It's got a console, shell console built into the web interface. You can do SQL direct to the database. You can look at flows in flight. You can look at the vault. You can look at transactions. You can click on all these things. It'll take you to the next thing. Most of this stuff updates in real time as well. So you can be looking at your vault, and as your node is transacting, more and more states will be coming in, updating, etc., etc. So it's a utility we're using because we're developers and we've written it for developers. And basically, if you talk to us, then you can have evaluation for free, obviously. But even if you want to use it commercially, then we can come to a really simple agreement, because basically we just, at the moment, we're not trying to make money from it. We just want people to use it, and we don't want to get sued if people do use it in production. so don't use it in production for now, but please use it in every other environment you want to see what's happening in your node.
Fantastic. And so tell us a bit about Renio DLT. I mean, how's that going? You know, what have you got any clients that you can tell us about?
Well, we've had a number of clients. Hopefully Polestar Global won't mind me mentioning them. They're a ship tracking company, and they're looking at putting information on the ledger regarding, say, bill of ladings, sanction screening, etc., so that when a boat turns up to, say, mainly, you know, New York harbors, whatever, the Coast Guard and immigration and the customs and excise can be certain that boat has been where it's supposed to have been and not done anything naughty on the way. And we had a client through 2020, which did about 7 or 8 research projects for them. I won't mention their name, but I know who they are. And they're super helpful at, you know, getting us to find our feet. And we just started this week with another client to do with some very exciting stuff, which, again, as it's super new, I can't mention the name of, but we're thinking that what they're doing is very exciting in terms of actually finally getting Corda used for basically bank-to-bank communication transactions about very specific types of things that they would like to transact about. So that's a bit of a nothing answer. I can see where you face it, Martin. Yeah.
Is that an exchange?
Who knows? Who knows?
Who knows? How exciting!
Who knows? Who knows? But we've got, you know, we've got this work going on. But we're always happy to talk to people, you know, big or small, about, you know, what they may want us to do and stuff like that. Because some of the things, you know, we could knock out in a couple of days if people want us to do a proof of concept or can Corda integrate with this ... And we can also do bigger stuff as well, as we've found out.
Well, I think that's a great place for us to finish it on. Thank you very much, Richard Green, for joining us on today's edition of From the Basement. And I wish you and everyone at Renio DOT the very best of luck.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you.
You've been listening to another episode of From the Basement. You can find all the previous episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And this show featured Richard Green, was presented by yours truly, Martin G, edited by Martin G, and was digitally generated by the one and only Oscar Big O Bennett. Because this is From the Basement!